on Straight Talk Africa, the World Bank and IMF Spring Meeting 2016. One key executive who attended for the first time as the economic voice for Africa is Dr. Akinwumi Adesina, president of the African Development Bank. That's coming up next right here on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, live from the Voice of America studios here in Washington. It's Wednesday, April 20th. I am Shaka Sali.
Hello, Shaka, and hello to all our viewers and listeners on the continent and elsewhere. I'm Ayan Bior, your social media reporter.
Today, we'll talk about the 2016 World Bank IMF Spring Conference and its relevance to Africa.
And coming up later in our STA inbox, you, our audience, have weighed in on our topic through your emails and Facebook comments, and we'll reveal some of them ahead on Straight Talk Africa.
Participants wrapped up the 2016 World Bank IMF Spring Conference with a call for structural reforms to uplift slowing global economy. My colleague Esther Githu-Ewart has more.
The two giant financial institutions bring economic and financial experts together in Washington, D.C. annually to discuss regional and international development and other financial concerns. Jim Yong Kim, president of the World Bank Group, painted a grim picture.
In the global economy, there are not many bright spots around the world. We've just downgraded our global growth forecast this year from 2.9% to 2.5%. In this period of global economic slowdown, we're also facing major global challenges, forced displacement, climate change, and pandemics. And I want to stress that each of these three represent very clear downside risks to the global economy.
In Africa, emerging economies are burdened by debt, poor infrastructure, and slow technology. Several West African countries that were making gains a few years ago are struggling to rebuild their economies and healthcare sectors following last year's Ebola epidemic. Others have been embroiled in political wrangles, ethnic and religious conflicts, forcing hundreds to flee their countries, while others are internally displaced. IMF Managing Director Christine Lagarde called for global cooperation to deal with refugee and migrant crisis.
Every second, nearly 30 people are displaced somewhere in the world. Now that requires bigger, broader, and bolder approach, and one that is certainly based on cooperation amongst the nations. It cannot be the affair of one country.
Jordan's Queen Rania spoke about the plight of refugees. Her country hosts nearly 500,000 Syrian refugees.
More than 90% are living in Jordan's cities, towns, and villages. A demographic shock that is exhausting our social and physical infrastructure to its absolute limit. We know all too well that in our interconnected world, a crisis in one place is a crisis in all places. And we know what happens when people look at their future and see nothing.
Terrorism remains a pressing concern. Nigeria is spending millions of dollars fighting Boko Haram militants, while Somalia and other East African countries have spent huge sums fighting Al-Shabaab militants. During a panel discussion to discuss displacement of peoples, Somalia's Minister for Women, Human Rights and Social Development, Sahra Ali Samatar, gave her perspective.
Government of Somalia comes from failed state to fragile, having all unrest, politics and challenges of security, challenges of services, challenges of terrorism. We know when there is a civil war, who are the most affected? Women and children.
Instability in many African countries is having a major impact on women and girls. The World Bank Group says it will invest $2.5 billion in education in the next 5 years, targeting adolescent girls in South Asia and sub-Saharan Africa. U.S. First Lady Michelle Obama welcomed the news.
It's an expression of our belief in the power of education to transform the lives and prospects of millions of girls worldwide, as well as the prospects of their families, their communities, and of course, their countries.
The World Bank's financial report on Africa concluded that economic activity in sub-Saharan Africa slowed down in 2015, while lower commodity prices have put pressure on currencies. Some countries have made gains due to the drop in oil prices. Poonam Chuan Paul is acting World Bank Africa chief economist.
Those countries that gain from the drop in oil prices are net oil importers, such as Kenya, Rwanda, and Ethiopia. We find that on average, the decline in the terms of trade has a larger negative impact on the region because of the large dependence on commodities in the continent.
Experts hope the three-pronged approach of fiscal, monetary, and structural actions will keep recession at bay and boost global financial stability. Esther Githui-Ewart, VOA News, Washington.
Thanks, Esther, for that report. After a short break, I'll have my exclusive interview with Dr. Akinwumi Adesina, president of the African Development Bank.
Like Voice of America on Facebook. Follow VOA on Twitter. Join VOA on our YouTube channel. Like, follow, join VOA.
Welcome back. Earlier this week, I had the opportunity to sit down with Dr. Adesina, president of the African Development Bank, and discuss some of Africa's key economic issues. Dr. Adesina, I have to say frankly that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host you for the first time on an edition of Straight Talk Africa.
Well, thank you very much, Anka. I've heard great things about you. It's a great pleasure to be here with you.
You're most welcome, sir.
Thank you.
Now, let me ask you, I gather that this is the first time that you have actually attended the spring conference of the World Bank and the IMF as a voice, as an economic voice of Africa. Tell us, what was the experience like?
Well, you know, it's great for me to be here. It's my first spring meeting, as you rightly said, as president of the African Development Bank. It's been fantastic. We discussed a range of issues. I think not least of them was the economic headwinds that Africa countries face and what those implications mean for Africa. And my position is that you take a look at Africa today, African economies are growing at, you know, average of 4.4% in terms of GDP growth rates. And the global economy is growing at 3.3%. It's been re-evaluated down to 3.2% by IMF. Europe is growing at 1.9%. So Africa is actually doing reasonably quite well. I think the message for me is that Africa is not unraveling by any chance. I think African economies have shown tremendous amount of resilience. So in tough times, Africa is still doing very well. And even the 4.4% that we all talk about, we forget that East Africa, for example, is growing at 6.5%. You know, so Africa continues to be the place to invest. I think we discussed quite a lot about that. I feel that the message is clear, that Africa is still the place to invest in.
What about the falling prices in terms of commodities, and we're talking about oil and gas?
Well, you know, the obviously, you know, for the last 10 years, you know, Africa has witnessed tremendous amount of growth on the back of a commodity super cycle that we have had, and largely because of the growth in China. You know, 85%, however, of the exports of Africa to China happens to be, you know, primary commodities, you know, whether it's minerals, metals, you know, agricultural products. And these tend to have cyclical behavior, and you have all these volatilities. Yes, they have been affected. You know, some countries more hard hit than others. You look at those that export oil, for example, big ones like Nigeria or Angola have been very badly hit. You know, Zambia, copper has been badly hit, and South Africa, and also Algeria and other countries. But that's not everything. I mean, I think you have those that are net importers of oil that also benefit. So you have an equilibration that actually goes on. Well, for me, the thing that comes out of this is first and foremost another lesson that we must learn again, which is that African economies absolutely have to diversify. But I also think it's another reminder of the importance for Africa to grow its own regional market because, you know, the countries that actually export into wider regional markets are always less susceptible to global commodity price volatilities. I think that's another thing that we must do. You know, as you know, in Africa today, only 11% of trade, intra-regional trade, happens between us. And I think we should have an Africa without borders. I think we should have an Africa where we can trade among ourselves. And this is critical to the work that we do at the African Development Bank. So in any way, all I'm saying is that the projections do show that Africa will recover to about 5.2-5.3% 2017-2018. So Africa will continue to be on an upswing, but I think we have to address structural issues, which is really get into agriculture that allows us to have inclusive growth and also deepen our work in investment in electricity, because without power, you have nothing.
Think about agriculture. I gather that you are a son of a farmer. You are, in fact, a legitimate farmer yourself. Mm. You studied agricultural economics.
Yes.
There was a time when your great country, Nigeria, was food self-sufficient. In fact, not only did it feed itself, it could even afford to export to other parts of the world. What happened?
It's not acceptable that a continent that has 65% of all the arable land left in the world to feed 9 million people by 2050 is not able to feed itself. It just doesn't make any sense. We have a lot of water, a lot of land, a lot of great sunshine, you know, and a great hardworking people. You throw up any seed before it hits the ground, literally it can grow anywhere in Africa. So I believe African countries should actually focus on agriculture, and Africa should be a global powerhouse in food and agriculture. You know, but what tends to happen is that, you know, the classic Dutch disease, and people find oil, you know, oil is, you don't do anything, you just scoop it, and so it's easier to do. And as that happens, you know, exchange rate appreciates, and therefore it becomes uncompetitive for agricultural sector now to grow. Now, I think when I was Minister of Agriculture in Nigeria, before I became President of the African Development Bank, you know, I took a position that we had to move away from just depending on oil to actually looking at the riches under our soil, the soil wealth itself, and that is in agriculture. But we have to start taking agriculture as a business, not as a way of life, and that's what we did. As president of the African Development Bank, I took the position that we're going to have some priorities, you know, and we set five priorities for ourselves at the bank. You know, and at the top of that priority is energy to light up and power Africa. Second one is to feed Africa, hence the point on agriculture. And on that one, what we really want to do is to allow African countries to unlock the potential of their agricultural sector.
Let's talk about energy. You obviously have more than 600 million Africans who have no access to electricity. How are you going to come up with the miracle of making sure that these people have unfettered access to that aspect of energy?
When you take a look at the problem, it's actually quite sad, and for me as an African, extremely embarrassing, that 138 years after Thomas Edison developed the light bulb, we can't light it. Makes no sense. Today you have 645 million Africans that don't have access to electricity. The kids can't go to school and learn. 90% of the schools in Africa, primary schools, over 95% don't have electricity. And you look at the number of secondary schools that don't have electricity. Right? Kids can't learn in the dark. Today, Africa loses roughly 5% of the GDP annually because of lack of electricity, because small and medium-sized businesses can't function. Vaccines in hospitals can't work. No, so we've got to also recognize that, period. Africa is simply tired of being in the dark, right? The lack of electricity in Africa is the greatest drag on our development. When you take a look at the amount of resources that we have, it's tremendous.
And we have so much sunshine that, you know, literally it's almost limitless. You know, we can have 11 terawatts of energy out of solar. You know, if you take a look at a hydro, right, huge amount of hydro potential, about 350 gigawatts of potential for hydro. And you look at the whole issue of wind, you're talking about another 150 gigawatts potential for wind. And in East Africa area, you have a lot of geothermal potential, probably another 15 gigawatts of potential. Not to talk of the fact that we have natural gas being flared into the air, like in Nigeria and other places, you know. And you also have access to coal, which is, you know, all across South Africa, Botswana, every other place. So literally, Shankara, Africa has no business, no business.
And South Africa, of course, has access to nuclear.
Nuclear, you know, for being in the dark. So what we've done is, I've said our priority in Africa is to help to light up and power Africa. And to do that within 10 years. And to do that, we require that we have a new conversation about energy. That's why the bank launched, the African Development Bank launched what we call the New Deal on Energy for Africa. Under that New Deal for Energy for Africa, we're hoping to connect 160 million people.
How are you going to fund it?
Well, if you take a look at the amount of resources we have in terms of taxes, right? Africa today generates about $500 billion in taxes every year. We're doing quite well in terms of in taxes now. If you just take 10% of that and you dedicate it to the energy sector, problem is all going to, almost going to be solved. Then you take a look also at what's going to happen with regard to the amount of money we have sitting out there in our pension funds. Today, Africa has, you know, about $334 billion in its pension funds. You know, you look at sovereign wealth funds, $163, $164 billion. Private equity funds, $20 billion. We've just got to get clever at leveraging this huge amount of resources into the energy sector. As the African Development Bank, the ways in which we're going to do that is we're going to invest $12 billion over the next 5 years in the energy sector. And part of that will be used to leverage $45 to $50 billion from the private sector.
Now joining me in our Washington studios is my distinguished guest, Dawit Giyogis, Executive Director of the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, an author, former Ethiopian Cabinet Minister, and a United Nations executive. I have to say, of course, after a very, very long time, that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host you one more time on Straight Talk Africa.
It's always an honor to be here, Shaka, and very glad that I see you once again. And I thank you very much for inviting me.
You're most welcome, sir. How have you been?
Good, good. I'm okay.
Terrific. Later in the program, we'll give you, the audience, a chance to call and talk with our guest. The number to call is 202-619-3111. Your country code is 1. Well, you heard him. You heard Dr. Adesina. He talks very interestingly about how it is more than 138 years ago when this great American Thomas Edison invented the electric bulb, and yet, for the most part on the continent, we simply cannot light it. Why?
It's very interesting to hear him state some uplifting figures that don't actually relate to the realities on the ground. His first statement is that Africa is the fastest growing economy. It's growing really much faster than Europe and Asia. But his stark statements about light energy, for example, in Africa, so many millions of people denied of the basic utility like light, and so that shows that the serious contradiction between what the World Bank, Africa Development Bank, the IMF say, and what we see actually on the ground. Realities on the ground is, I feel that there's a lot happening, but Africa is moving more or less either stagnant economy or as moving backwards rather than forward. That's what we see on the reality. It's not only in the energy sector, but in all other sectors, Africa is not doing at all. The figures might say something else. The figures are calculated in a system which is not related to the situation on the ground.
So but do you agree with some critics, in fact, who have been saying that when you hear some of these intellectuals, some of these top executives talking about statistics, these are measurements that hardly reflect, for example, the neighborhoods in which people live, or hardly, in fact, reflect the stomachs of the people themselves?
Absolutely, Shaka. It does not reflect the realities on the ground. Like the president was referring to Africa. Which Africa is he talking about? Let's see, which Africa are we talking about? If we see Africa now from east to west, the entire belt of Africa is in turmoil, instability, insecurity. And you can't say much about Africa, sub-Sahara, except those countries in Southern Africa. Most of North Africa and all the West African countries have severe problems of either governance or security. So in the absence of proper governance and security, development cannot take place. The largest economy in Africa is his country, the president's country, Nigeria. Can you imagine Nigeria, the largest oil-producing country, but now people queuing for oil, people queuing for the basic needs. So this is...
For petrol.
And for petrol, and the northern part of the continent in turmoil.
Boko Haram.
With Boko Haram. So Nigeria, the realities on the ground, doesn't warrant any growth at all. The figures are wrong. He talked about East Africa. What we're talking about? East Africa is Sudan. Sudan, North and South Sudan are in turmoil. South Sudan is more or less in a failed state. Somalia is a failed state. Djibouti is a small country. We cannot talk about that. It's only Ethiopia we're talking about. Ethiopia is an economy which is not based on anything, on export or manufacturing. It's mostly aid, grant money that's been circulating in Ethiopia, except Ethiopia, which is also a manipulatory figure, because if you see Ethiopia, right at this moment, 15 million people are hungry. We need assistance for the 15 million people. Now, if Ethiopia was really the fastest growing economy, it should have fed itself. It did not feed itself. Nigeria is not feeding itself. So all these things does not add up. It doesn't add up. There is some problem. Either the figures are manipulated, exaggerated, or there must be a new way of measuring the level of development in Africa.
Let's talk about your country of Ethiopia. You just mentioned that more than 15 million human beings are hungry. And yet, you do have a situation where the government has attracted investors who have in fact come and invested in producing flowers.
Yeah.
In fact, I think Ethiopia is the largest, country that produces roses.
Yeah.
How come some African governments really, for some strange reason, have their priorities upside down?
Absolutely. You know better, Shaka, we have our priorities upside down. Is it flour that needs to come to the priority or food for the people? So, yes, there are, because of this land grabbing now, there are many countries in the Gulf area and from Asia that, and in many wealthy people and wealthy companies now are grabbing land in Ethiopia. They are growing food, but the food is not consumed internally. It's food for export. That's also a screwed up priority, that priority. But what we need is people, government, producing country internally to feed its own people. That's not what's happening. Ethiopia is more or less a fertile country, a country which has reasonable rain. It's not an arid country. It is, yes, highly populated.
Of course, the source of the Blue Nile.
The source of the Blue Nile and lots of water. And you see, if you go to Ethiopia, and I'm quite sure you have been there, if you go now, you see the same agricultural technology that Ethiopians have been using 100 years ago. Still, the oxen and the plow, and that's what we have. So the agricultural technology has not changed. The agricultural inputs have not really increased a lot. And there is some problem with the land distribution also, but that's basic problems that are hindering countries like Ethiopia to feed themselves.
What about the Great Lakes region? You, of course, talked about energy. And you know as well as I do that you have this great Inga Dam, for example.
Yes.
In the Democratic Republic of Congo.
The Congo, yeah.
I have been told by experts that, in fact, that dam has the capacity, the ability to light the entire continent.
Absolutely.
That's how come nothing is coming out of that region?
Again, the problem of the Congo, there is on the part of the people, there is a willingness, and the new government, there's a lot of attempt to really change the economy, to improve the economy. But the problem of Congo has been haunted by security problems since independence. It's got nine neighbors, nine of them, most of them have got problems of security, and the spillover has all the time affected Congo, and the internal stability is not yet solid. So that is, Congo has the largest resource in Africa in terms of water, the amount of water, the amount of arable land it has.
You name it.
You name it, Congo has it. God gave everything to Congo except stability. And the most important factor now that's holding Congo back is stable government, a stable society, and good relationship with its neighbors.
Joseph Kabila has been president in that country since, of course, the assassination of his father back in 2001. How come he has not been able to deliver on that?
Yeah, I've been asking that question. I think he, as a young man, he has a lot of energy, and I think he was trying to stabilize himself and the government, and he has not succeeded. But a sense of stability exists in the Congo. But would they be able to go to the next phase? But again, the issue of governance comes. Now, there is, from what I read and from what I hear, Kabila is trying to run for a third term. Is that genuine? Is that sincere? Is that proper? You ask these questions. African heads of states trying to change the constitution and staying there forever. That's what the problem of many leaders there. So it's a governance problem also. But I think, from what I saw a few months ago in the Congo, there is a sincere effort to change Congo. I hope they succeed.
Why do they change these constitutions, which in fact they swear to uphold, to defend and protect?
Shaka, you have talked to many heads of states yourself, to many politicians. Politicians are unpredictable. When you talk to them on a personal level, they give you a very different story. But then they get to the power, to hold power, their personality completely changes. They are not the kind of people. And these are people, they are not uneducated people. They are educated leaders we have. They have been exposed to democracy. They know about democracy. They talk about democracy more than you and I. And yet, when they stay in the position of power, they want to hold on to it forever. What? That's the disease.
Is that what you call education, or is it, in fact, miseducation?
Probably miseducation.
Right? I mean, these are people who at least consider themselves to be God's gift, frankly, to their own countries.
Absolutely.
Now let's continue with the second part of my conversation with Dr. Adesanya, president of the African Development Bank. Let's talk about drought in Southern Africa. I gather, in fact, that you were recently in Southern Africa. How is the African Development Bank responding to that catastrophe?
When you take a look at the situation with climate change, Africa today just contributes, 2% to the greenhouse gas emissions in the world. But we suffer disproportionately from the negative impact of the climate change. For us, the impact of climate change is not in the future. No, it's now. It's right here and now. When I went on the trip that you saw to South Africa just last week, I went to Malawi, and I was in Mozambique, but also in South Africa. And while I was in Malawi, and I it was almost like a diplomatic, security thing. When the convoy going to the airport, you know, and I saw all these farms that were brown, and I just asked the convoy to stop. You know, somebody who grew up on the farm, somebody who knows agriculture, I know that it means that livelihoods have already been destroyed. So I got out of the car, ran to the fields, and I started looking at the maize cobs that are there. And, you know, I took these maize cobs, and they were like this. Malawi today has 8.4 million people that are food insecure as a result of the El Nino drought problem.
Wow.
Last year, because they had flood, it was 2.8 million. But look at them today, 8.4 million people that were food insecure. Now, what's the bank doing? Immediately, I announced that the bank, the African Development Bank, will make available $549 million, you know, to support
countries to be able to adjust to this quickly.
Is that a loan or a grant?
No, it is basically emergency support operations for them to be able to do it. And the other one is we reprogram a lot of our monies to be able to give them direct budget support to be able to cope with the huge amount of people that are now food. The African Development Bank, we are also going to support a lot of climate resilient agriculture. We are also going to look at how to support significant amount of crop insurance for many farmers. And in terms of climate finance, I've said, you know, that we will increase, we'll triple our climate finance to $5 billion a year by 2020. So we all have to help Africa to do a lot to adapt to the negative impacts of climate change.
The majority of the African population today is made up of very young people. Mm. A lot of these young people do not have skills, frankly, to help them earn a living. I guess that you have at the bank a project in place. Can you talk about it?
So we are launching at the bank what's called Jobs for Africa's Youth Initiative. This initiative, Shankar, is designed to create 25 million jobs for young people within 10 years. It's going to focus a lot on building their skills. Mm-hmm. There's going to be rural youth looking at agriculture. There are going to be graduates that are looking at different parts of the value chains in agriculture. There's going to be a lot of focus on ICT, capacity building. There's going to be a lot also on small and medium-sized enterprises of young people. And also creating a fund that allows the business of young people on the continent to thrive. You know, I don't believe the future of Africa's young people lies in migrating out of Africa. I think we ought to build a more robust and much more inclusive growth process in Africa that allows us to turn our demographic asset into an economic dividend for our young people. And I'm quite excited already with what we are seeing. We have an initiative, for example, that is called Enable Youth in Agriculture, that are getting doctors and lawyers and architects, young people that go into agriculture as a business. When I was Minister of Agriculture in Nigeria, I set up something called agropreneurs, which is a way of getting young people into agriculture as a business. Mm-hmm. You know, and I wore my bow ties all the time as a Minister of Agriculture in Nigeria, basically because I wanted the young people to understand that agriculture is a wealth-creating sector. It's not what you thought about, you know. I mean, after all, the biggest business in the world is the food business.
You know, there was this great British imperialist called Sir John Cecil Rhodes. He had a dream of a road that would link Cape Town to Cairo. Is that a possibility under the African Development Bank? Because can he imagine, in fact, what it could do to open up all these markets?
We believe that the most important thing for Africa is to be well integrated, right? And that requires a lot of infrastructure. We have 54 countries, but you have a lot of landlocked countries.
Correct.
And you have those that have ports. So one thing that the bank has done very well is to invest in, you know, transnational highways, to invest more in ports, strategic ports, but also to invest in fiber optics that allow you to have internet connectivity across African countries. Infrastructure is the key.
Personal note, how is it like to be the president of the African Development Bank? Can you walk us through a day in the life of Dr. Adesina, the president of the African Development Bank?
Well, you know, as president of the African Development Bank, I don't think I have a job. It's not a job for me at all.
Why?
It's a mission.
It is a mission.
It's a mission because I hear the voices of the kids that need to go to school. I hear the voices of the farmers that are locked in poverty that need to come out of it. I hear the voices of poor households that need to send their girls to school, but they are spending 10 hours, the girls going to look for water, therefore they miss out school. You know, you look at a situation where a continent has, 58 million kids that are stunted. Now, those are the things that drive me. It's a mission for me. It's not a job. My day starts always about how do we find solutions to the crippling problems that bother us.
Like what time do you wake up, for example?
Oh, I wake up very, very early. And I always wake up early to pray as well. Because, it's not, something you can do always with your physical strength. But not only prayer for myself, but prayer for my colleagues and partners and all the others that we are working with. And you come to work, you basically, you know, talk quite a lot to countries, heads of state. You're motivating, you're working and motivating at the same time. So I think the life of a president of African Development Bank is one in which there's a lot of high expectations. And Africans should have high expectations.
What is it that you need to do, that you must do, in order for you to consider yourself a success?
Over the next 10 years, we absolutely have to light up Empower Africa. People are talking about fourth industrial revolution today, but we're not even in the first one, just because we don't have access to electricity. So electricity for Africa, universal, is key. Second is that I think Africa is just about time for Africa to actually fully feed itself, you know. And I think that can be done in 10 years. If I know that we have more kids that have been to school, we've been able to provide a lot of water and sanitation, decent housing for people. We've been able to create a lot of jobs for young people. And we have an Africa that is lit up and able to feed itself. I can rest well.
What would you say so far has been the single most important decision that you have made? And what about the single most regrettable decision during your presidency?
Well, I think the most important decision that I have made is to get the bank to focus on what it can deliver on. And those are the high fives. We've done a lot of work over the last couple of months that I've been there. I've only been there now for almost 7 months, but it looks like I've been there for over 2 years. That is, focus so that we can be held more accountable and work better with others. And so that is light up Empower Africa. Feed Africa, integrate Africa, you know, industrialize Africa, and improve the quality of life for the people of Africa. We call them high fives. Those are the things we've been able to brand ourselves for that we are going to be held accountable for. And that's going very, very well. We have a lot of support behind us for that. Now, in terms of I don't have any regrets. I think I actually have a lot more excitement.
What about lessons learned so far?
Well, the lessons that we've learned so far is that to solve a lot of challenges in Africa requires more than the African Development Bank. I don't want the bank that follows. I want the African Development Bank to lead, because we are set up to do that. But we have to work with others. And my way of working is what I always call co-development, working with others to be able to work on big problems and to be able to deliver faster.
I have two questions which were submitted by one of our interns from West Africa. Samose Diaro, he asks, how do you measure the impact of the ADB policies, and what makes the ADB different from the World Bank?
Good question. You know, in measuring the impact of the work of the bank, you have to realize that our work is in three ways. First, we give a lot of loans, we give grants, and we give a lot of guarantees to countries. So you look at the size of funds that we actually give to countries. Last year, for example, you know, we gave $9 billion. And $2.2 billion of that actually went to the private sector. So it's the extent to which we are able to mobilize capital to help countries. And how do we do that? It's important to see that is that we use our preferential status, right, because of our big capital shareholding to be able to raise money off the capital markets at cheap rates. And then we unlend that to countries. So when we lend to countries, we lend to them all that money at 0.6% interest rate. You can imagine.
I see.
And for a period of 40 years. So I think that's one way in which we do. What makes us different from the World Bank? First, we are African Development Bank. We were created to help to accelerate the development of Africa. And I think you'll find out that African countries see us as their bank. And because we understand the context very well, we work very closely with them. But of course, we work very closely with the World Bank, as well with IMF and all the others. But we're primarily an African Development Bank who must carry on its shoulders the hopes and aspirations of a continent.
You are tuned into Straight Talk Africa. We'll have more of a discussion in a moment. But first, here is INBOR. Take it away, Ayen.
Thanks, Shaka. Still to come, we'll reveal some of the fantastic feedback we've received from you, our audience, through social media. But now here's our letter of the week from a Straight Talk Africa Facebook fan. Our letter of the week comes from Mohamed Ahmed Mansour from Freetown, Sierra Leone. He writes, "The policies of the World Bank and the IMF have come under increasing fire for the negative impact they have had on African countries. But these institutions, the U.S. and other wealthy countries that control them, have refused to address these concerns. Instead, they continue to use Africa's debt as leverage to maintain control over the economic policies of African countries. Even as Africa faces the worst health crisis in human history, these institutions insist that debt repayment take priority over spending in the fight against HIV/AIDS.
Today's youth are not just the next generation of African leaders, they are today's leaders. And this is the time to invest in them, today, not tomorrow. So let's connect, let's engage with each other on issues that will transform our societies. Innovation, leadership, entrepreneurship, things that you're doing to move the continent forward to make you the greatest generation that Africa has known. It's Upfront every Wednesday, 1730 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
This is Straight Talk Africa on The Voice of America. Call us now with your questions and comments. The number 202-619-3111. And the U.S. country code is 1. Call us collects and we'll pay for the call. Or call directs and we'll call you right back. Remember to keep your questions brief. Now back to Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much, Esther Githu-Yuwat, and welcome back to Straight Talk Africa, live from Washington. Once again, it's time to bring in my colleague and social media reporter, Ayen. Take it away again, Ayen.
Thanks, Shaka. We received tremendous feedback in our STA inbox to this week's question. As we've mentioned, thousands of government officials, journalists, civil society organizations, and participants from the academia and private sectors were in Washington, D.C. for the spring meetings of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank Group. This leads us to our question of the week, which asks, what issues concerning Africa should stakeholders of the World Bank and IMF be most concerned about? Before we begin, I'd like to thank all of you for using all our social media platform to communicate with us. And another reminder that we are tweeting live today. Use the hashtag VOA2016 Spring Meetings. And if you haven't yet, please do follow us at VOA Shaka. And speaking of, let's go to a tweet from Prince Habat Nakula, who tweets, I'm most concerned about the corruption scandals and shoddy work funded by the World Bank in Uganda. And we have another tweet from George Will Awoye, who tweets, electricity, good governance, and security are what the World Bank and IMF should be most concerned about. And our last tweet is from John Ruhir, who tweets, two institutions should supply resources to help when needed and not a means of Western political impositions and stealing. Now to a comment from a Facebook fan, Aminua Akubo from Abuja, Nigeria, who writes, the International Monetary Fund should be deeply concerned about its reputation among the good people of Africa. It should see its primary role as that of bringing about sustainable development to all continents of the world, including Africa. Well, Shaka and DeWitt, there certainly is no shortage of views and opinions here. What's your take?
Very interesting. DeWitt, your reaction, please.
Yes. I appreciate the eloquence of the president of the bank. He really outlined the problems and the challenges, but a lot needs to be done, more than what he said. There is a lot to be seen in action. But about the questions that have been just issued now, the questions that are posed, I feel, and many researchers and Africans feel, the most serious challenge at this moment in Africa, the most serious since the decolonization process now in Africa, is security problems. Security problems and that is terrorism, one, extremism, and transnational crimes. These are fundamental problems that needs to be addressed by governments. And like it's been said earlier during the address of the World Bank by the Queen of the Jordan, it's not the problem that we have here in Africa is not the security challenges are not issues that can be addressed by one country. It's a continental problem. It's a regional problem. Africa needs to address these issues, and there cannot be any meaningful development without addressing the issue of security. If we see most of Africa, the entire north of Africa, probably two countries who are in a relatively peace. Otherwise, the entire North Africa has got severe security problems. North Africa, the Arab countries, those bordering the Mediterranean Ocean. If we see sub-Saharan Africa, from East Africa to West Africa, there is no single country that has not been either severely or moderately affected by security problems. If we go to the Gulf of Guinea has now become the most dangerous maritime zone in the world. All the 18 countries along the Gulf of Guinea are severely affected by that. If we go to the Red Sea, that Gulf, the Gulf of Aden and the Red Sea used to be the most dangerous maritime zone in the world earlier, but it remains to be a very difficult area, particularly now since the eruption of the civil war in North Yemen. So we see, we see from across the belt of Africa, from east to west, there are severe problems. So when we discuss about development, I don't understand it because I don't see that there can happen any meaningful development program in this kind of problem where the prevailing issue becomes security.
I will come back to that and perhaps ask you the fundamental root causes of instability. In fact, it is on record that a lot of African countries spend a lot of their money buying weapons. Well, thanks, Ayen, for bringing us this week's audience reaction.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure, Shaka. And that does it for today's social media segment. Just a reminder that we appreciate all the feedback, whether it's in social media form or using other means to communicate to us. Please keep them coming. And if you're a new fan, drop us a line at africatv@voanews.com. Once again, our email address is africatv@voanews.com. Or post your comment on our Facebook page. Enter the keyword Straight Talk Africa. Be sure to visit us online at voaafrica.com. Or you can join our YouTube channel. Sign up to VOA TV to Africa. And follow us on Twitter at @VOAShaka. A reminder that the show is streaming live every Wednesday. Go to VOA Straight Talk Africa TV program page on our website. Or simply watch us live on your mobile device. Just download the VOA mobile app. Now let's take a look at what's on tap for next week's program. Next week on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss the politics of South Sudan, reconciling and uniting the nation. Join host Shaka Sali, his panel of guests, and me, Ayen Bior, your social media reporter, as we talk about South Sudan. That's next week on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much, Esther Githui-Ewart. And of course, next week, we'll be looking at developments in South Sudan. Now, let me come to you, my friend Dawit. You talked about, really, how the issue that perhaps need to be looked at, frankly, is the issue of security. And yet people will tell you, my brother, that African governments spend lots of amounts of money on buying AK-47s, buying tanks, buying all sorts of weapons. Are they perhaps missing the picture? Because the last time I checked, someone said, you can't talk about security, perhaps without talking, frankly, about the root causes of insecurity. And that part of the reason we have this security problem is precisely because governments have not been able to address the fundamental issues, which are socio-economic justice, which are accountability, and in some cases, reconciliation.
It's true. It's very true, Shaka. It's very, very true. That is the underlying issue, the challenges that many governments face. The root causes is easy to see in all African countries, but how do we address that? This is about the issues about governance.
Correct.
It's governance related to corruption. And I was doing some research at some point about trafficking of arms. It's a very complex issue. Sometimes manufacturers of guns, mm-hmm. they create the problem so that to sell the guns. Mm-hmm. So the manufacturers are mm-hmm. involved. Mm-hmm. The shippers are involved. Uh-huh. The brokers are involved. So there are so many issues that are involved in gun business. So it is sad that many Africans, because when we talk about security, many African governments see security as regime security. It's, we talk about human security, not regime security. If it's regime security, it's only through guns that you'll be able to provide security to the government. But if we talk about human security in the broader form, it's the migration. It is the food security. It is the displacement of people. It's the economic needs of the people. These can only be addressed through proper governance. But that is, sadly, it's not happening, but it is, I'm quite sure, a discussion that's ongoing discussion in Africa.
Let me go to the lifeline of the show, which are the telephone callers. Good evening, Sam from Uganda. You're most welcome to Straight Talk Africa.
Good evening, Dr. Shakasari. How are you?
I am hugely terrific, except that I happen to be a doctor, but without a clinic.
Okay, let me talk to Dewitt. Mr. Dewitt, you have talked about security in Africa, which of course goes with economic progress. What do you comment on the Southern Sudan crisis, whereby we were expecting Dr. Machar to arrive in Juba, and all of a sudden, in a tweet of a second, he decided not to go to Juba? Secondly, how can African countries secure long-term loans in order to develop electricity all around the continent, so that they can help the rural people who want to give up? Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you very much, Sam, too.
Yeah, thank you very much, Mr. Koller. I forgot your name.
Sam.
Yeah, Sam. It is, yes, a problem. I have been to South Sudan. I have worked in South Sudan. And I have really experienced the agony and the poverty of the Southern Sudanese people. They don't deserve what they are getting right now. It is sad, and I fully agree with many people that the problem in South Sudan is the wisdom of the leadership. They have to exercise wisdom for the sake of those extremely poor people who are paying a price because there is a power struggle between two and three ethnic groups. I think what we need to encourage the leaders is to exercise wisdom and really go beyond their self-interest and address the issues of the people. So it's just we appeal to the wisdom and intellect of our leaders. The security of our people in Sudan entirely depends on the wisdom exercised by these leaders.
But you know, when you look at the geographical location of South Sudan, you really have to feel sorry for them. Because look north, you have Sudan. Look east, you have Ethiopia. Look west, you have Central African Republic. Look southwest, you have DRC. Look south, you have Uganda. You have Somalia within the region and what have you. Are you surprised at this, despite the fact that South Sudan, actually in terms of geography, perhaps is much larger than the entire East African community countries combined, except that it will soon, of course, be one of the members itself. And when you look at the human beings there, frankly, they are very few. There is more than enough for everybody.
Absolutely.
Why?
Absolutely. I have not seen a country in Africa that is as rich, naturally, as rich as Congo and South Sudan, extremely rich. They have all the resources, and they will have no reason at all to fight against each other. But again, we cannot explain, of course, this complex issues surrounding South Sudan has got an effect, definitely. But also the most important responsibility, the most crucial responsibility, is the responsibility of the leaders. The leaders themselves, they are accountable for whatever is happening to the Southern Sudanese people. They are accountable. Of course, there are other factors that play into this, but the most important at this moment is the leadership.
No, when you talk about the leadership, there are some leaders in the region who actually have made a career out of making sure that there is enough violence to go around so that they can stay in power.
Yeah.
They must have read, of course, this English philosopher called John Milton, who wrote in Paradise Lost, that I would rather serve in hell than, rather, I would rather rule in hell than serve in heaven. Paradise Lost, John Milton.
Well, that's interesting, very sad, but that seems to be the reality in Africa at this moment, in many African countries. That is sad, yeah.
Well, there are great leaders who make it because there is war. There was once, of course, British Prime Minister Winston Churchill. He was a great war prime minister. When there was no war,
he collapsed.
No job.
Yeah, there's no job, but in a democratic country, leaders give way to another leader, and then there is at least a change of policies. But in Africa, when leaders stay in power for long and change the constitution and stay longer, then that is a serious problem. We can't have change. In South Sudan, that's the problem. In many African countries, that in sub-Saharan Africa, except in southern part of Africa, which is more democratic than many in Central and West Africa. But the problem has always been leadership, leadership, leadership.
But, Dawit, you were once, of course, an officer and a gentleman of the Ethiopian Army. You were a captain, and I salute you because I was only a lieutenant. You have been a cabinet minister. You are a trained lawyer. You've been a senior United Nations executive. You know, mention it really, you've done it. What is it that can help to explain to an ordinary mind, an ordinary person, why, for example, an individual who becomes a dictator can control millions of people? Why can't these people stand up and say, wait a minute, we can't take this anymore?
Yeah, it's a big question. It's a big question. But again, that's what surprised me also, because the kind of leaders that we see in Africa at this moment are not coming from the jungles. They are not illiterate people. These are people who have well-read, who have probably been educated in one of the Western countries, democratic countries, but when they go back home, when they return home, they become entirely different animals. They start exercising dictatorship. They start exercising contrary to what they have seen and they have been exposed to. That is very sad, but I think psychologists can explain. But again, the major problem is we don't have the democratic institutions and the culture to be able to restrain our leaders, to be able to fight when they refuse to accept the rule of law, well, to be able to fight them, not necessarily physically, but to fight them and to bring them down when they allow themselves to operate against the constitution. We don't have the democratic institutions. We don't have the culture. That might take some time, perhaps.
You know, it was the current First Lady of the United States, Michelle Obama, who once said that becoming a president does not change you. It reveals you.
That's interesting. That's very good. That's a very good say. That's
so some of these people that you think are what you think they are may, in fact, at the end of the day, be political conmen.
Absolutely. I think I agree with that. That's a very good statement there.
You got it. Well, on that note, thanks to our distinguished guest, Dawit Giyogis, Executive Director of the Africa Center for Strategic Studies. Thanks to our affiliate stations, along with our viewers and listeners, we thank you for tuning in. For many of our Voice of America radio affiliates, Learning English is coming up next. And tomorrow morning, it's Daybreak Africa with James Bate. On behalf of the Voice of America, thanks for tuning in to Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not beta Africa. And please remember to keep the African hopes alive.